You are listening to Punk News Podcast, episode 547.5, a very cool bonus episode. This is features editor John Gentile, and in this episode, I talk to Ellen Foley, the legend. Of course, most of you probably know Ellen Foley has been on so many amazing records, and she's done other stuff too. She's been in TV, she's been in film. Most of you probably know her from her work with The Clash. She's does a lot of the background vocals on Sandinista, and she does a little bit on Combat Rock. But before that, she actually sang the female vocals in Meatloaf's Paradise by Dashboard Light. But then after, oh, and also, she was on a lot of Mick Ronson and Ian Hunter records, Ian Hunter solo stuff. So she's there. After that, she did some more solo records. She was also in Night Court, and of course, she was also on Ghost Rider as the principal. And we talk about all that on the upcoming podcast. She's got a new album coming out that's real cool. I've heard it. The album is called Fighting Words, and that's going to be out on August 6th. We're going to talk to Ellen right now, but before that, let's play one of her brand new tracks that's real cool. The track is called I'm Just Happy to Be Here, off her new album, or upcoming album, Fighting Words. Well, here we are, Ellen. If you don't, you've had an amazing career so far, and you're doing cool things right now. If I read this, someone, here's all the things Ellen has done, they wouldn't believe. They would think I was making it up. So,
no,
if it's all right,
I love it.
We'll just go through, you know, a little bit here, a little bit there, and work up to the present because you've got a cool new album coming out, which I dig. The lead track people can hear right now. It's called "I'm Just Happy to Be Here." It's a cool track. I've heard the album. It's a cool album. So if you don't mind, let's jump to the past and work to the present. How does that sound?
Sounds good to me, John.
All right. So, Ellen, what were your early years like? You know, like you know, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Did you have a good time? Did you have a bad time? Where did you grow up?
I grew up in St. Louis. 3, 4, 5. Let me think. I was kind of an only kid because I had two half-sisters and they were out of the house. They're 14 and 16 years older than me. My one sister got married when she was like 19. But anyway, so I was raised kind of as an only child. But I went to, Catholic grade school, actually high school too. And everybody, you know, had 7 or 8 brothers, you know, so I think I was a little lonely, and I think I was, you know, a mama's girl, and yeah, a little had some separation anxiety, and maybe that played out in my earlier adult years, you know. So those were the early ones. But then, you know, I went to Catholic school, and, you know, the first years were the nuns were rough. But then, like, I would say maybe 4th, 6th grade, I found my humor and sort of became the class clown, and then, you know, got the leads in the musicals and all that. So it was kind of pretty good sailing after that, because I was able to discover, you know, some humor. I think that's the most important thing for anybody, if they can laugh and make other people laugh, I think.
So you said you started singing around middle school or so. Like when you first started singing in the plays and musicals, was it like, wow, I can do this? Or was it kind of a gradual thing that you grew more and more into?
No, I mean, it was funny. I don't think it was 8th grade, 6th grade. I don't know my memory. That was a long time ago. But to audition for the first musical I ever did, I sang Goldfinger. You know, Goldfinger. You know, and here's this, like, this little, you know, 11-year-old kid belting out, go, he's a man. I'm, you know, doing my best Shirley Bassey. So I always think, I don't know what they thought, but when I think back on it, I think it's pretty good, funny. But, and then the result of that was they made a play. It was kind of neat that they, it was an original play, but it was called Wider Than a Mile. But this kid who's going down a river and having experiences, and he meets me, and I sing People. I sing friggin' People, you know, the Barbra Streisand song. So, yeah, I think I discovered that, you know, the belty, the big voice thing pretty early on. And then high school after that, I was in a girls' high school. So I did the musicals at the boys' high school, right? And so I did Adelaide and Guys and Dolls. I mean, you know, one of the greatest parts. And she's funny, and she gets to belt. And, you know, so I was lucky to have early experiences. And also I had a nun in my high school who was the speech and the drama coach and teacher, and I really always see her as kind of my first mentor. She really encouraged me. You know,
it's interesting that you bring that. You know, if you watch some movies, you know, the nuns are often portrayed as these strict people that hate everything. But then in some other movies, they kind of like encourage musical and artistic pursuits. So at that time, you had, I guess, an encouraging nun or whatever.
I did. I mean, the early nuns were, you know, I never got hit or beat or anything like that. But they were, you know, these, you know, older, you know, uneducated. You know, nuns don't get much education, you know, back then in the primary school. I mean, you know, I don't think anybody went to college. They were in the convent, and they said, go teach these kids. So, you know, they weren't probably sophisticated. By the time I got to high school, these women were. You know, it was a girls' school. It was a fast-track school. So, yes, yeah, so the curriculum and the atmosphere was really great for me. It was good not having boys and wearing uniforms, because you didn't have to, you know, like I watch movies like Grease and everybody's wearing spandex and seeing if they're going to date John Travolta. But, you know, it wasn't not like that in a girls' school. So, you know, I'm still happy that that's where my life was back then.
As a teenager, what kind of music were you listening to? What were you checking out?
Well, you know, I mean, earlier on, you know, it was the Four Tops and the Temptations. You know, then the 60s got, you know, there were some Beatles, but I was always, you know, a Stones advocate. When I was 14, I went to see them. You know, it was their first tour in the States. And that's when, you know, something really clicked that I wanted to be this guy. But I, you know, I liked Jefferson Airplane and Jimi Hendrix, and I did like the Sgt. Pepper record. And of course, when I was younger, there were the girl groups. I remember the first single I ever bought was "He's So Fine." I don't even remember who that was by, but it was one of the girl groups. And the Spectre thing, you know, and that's also, you know, influenced the way I sing and how some of my records were produced, you know, Ellen, that kind of stuff.
Ellen, we're going to be great friends. I know, because the Stones are my favorite band. What was it like seeing them? Because you don't hear people talk about, you know, people should talk about like the 70s era. What was it like seeing them on their first U.S. tour? Like, it's, you know, when you see them on like Ed Sullivan, they're wearing like, you know, like, I would call it like turtlenecks and stuff, and you know, they're playing their music, but at the time that was portrayed as being extremely dangerous. Like, what was it like seeing them on the first U.S. tour?
Well, you know, a kid I met, you know, in this sort of, you know, acting class I was in, he said, come see this. I didn't know anything about it, so I remember it was in kind of a very cool, it felt like a small theater. It was a theater, you know, it wasn't a club, it was a theater. And Mick Jagger was wearing this baggy white suit, and it was really high fashion. You know, you didn't know it, but it was very high fashion. It wasn't those stupid, yeah, turtlenecks when they were trying to be, I don't know who, but, you know, and, he's the only one I remember, to tell you the truth, because I guess I don't know what everybody else was wearing, but it was just the, you know, I think I was concentrating mainly on him, and he would do things like, you know, stand with his back to the stage, to the audience, and lean over and sing between his legs. You know, I'm like, holy crap, you know, and it was dangerous. You know, I remember before I went to see them, all the press was like, you know, look at these disgusting, like, what the big line was, would you let your daughter date a Rolling Stone? You know, so, and so that was intriguing to me, because of course I would have loved to date a Rolling Stone. I didn't even know it, but you know, I loved rock and roll, and I sparked to that, you know, because of them, I think.
And then not too long after that comes, I guess, Ellen's first big hit was Paradise by Dashboard Light. How did that come about? Did Jim Steinman call you up? Who invited you, I guess, into the studio to come sing that iconic song?
Well, you know, I knew them because we were like the year or 2 years before we recorded it, we were on tour with something called the National Lampoon Show. And it was you know, the satiric sketches, very irreverent. And we did it. It was done in New York, and John Belushi and Gilda Radner were in it. But we did it on tour, you know, so Meat did like a lot of the Belushi parts. I did the Gilda parts. And so Jim came along because he and Meat had had worked together and wanted to do an album. So Jim came along to be the music director, which means he, you know, we all drove around in this blue van, you know, the whole cast and crew, and he, music director, which means he was, he played the piano. And as you probably know, Steinman can be a one-man band because he really bangs on a piano keys. So to have that, I mean, it was amazing because they're original songs from this National Lampoon thing. So anyway, he was writing it. And, you know, I was there and I was singing and he wrote the song. I mean, that's simple as that. So, but I went along with them, the year or more, you know, auditioning, for record company, guys. And, you know, it was a big no from many companies for a long time, but, you know, they didn't give up. Their manager, David Sonnenberg, you know, kept pumping away until we found a record label and with Steve Popovich at Cleveland International. But it took a long time because it freaked people out to have, because they were in these small rehearsal rooms, to have somebody like Meatloaf standing like 4 feet away from you singing these huge, you know, operatic songs. So, yeah, I was kind of in on the whole thing early on.
I guess your vocal response in that song is amazing. Did you like have to do a whole bunch of takes on that, or was it like a one and done thing? Like I nailed it right off the bat. What was the construction of that like?
Exactly, it was one and done. Nailed it off the bat.
Did you know that like, this is going to be huge, or you just thought like it was another track and we'll see what happens?
I guess I didn't think it was another track because I knew it was extraordinary, but I would never have assumed that it was going to be such a huge thing. You know,
what's it like to be heard on the radio every day in every major city in the United States? Like, what's that like? What's that feeling? You know, people can hear you probably 24 hours a day on the radio in the United States. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I guess I wasn't thinking of it that way. I just remember being like early on, I was in a taxi cab. I was touring in Europe and I came home and I was in a taxi on my way back from the airport. And it came on and I said, taxi player said, that's me singing. Da, da, da. Of course, he looked at me like I was crazy. Then many years later, after I was more grown up, I was at a street fair in my neighborhood and some guy had a radio in his booth. And I did that again. That's me. And he looked at me like I was insane. But yeah, I mean, it's major cool, you know, knowing that it gets played on the radio. And I love when these radio stations do like the countdown, like the end of year or the top 100 songs. And it's always really close to the top, you know, and that is a great feeling. And it is. It's like a universal thing, you know. I can say it to even younger kids, and they know what it is.
What's Meatloaf like as a person? Is he like a normal guy, or is he an eccentric genius? What's he like as a person?
He's not a normal guy. He's an eccentric performer. You know, he's hypersensitive. You know, but he can be very loving, very, very sensitive to other people too. But he's I'd say a way to describe his personality is very dramatic and theatrical.
And then I think before your first solo album, you did two tracks with Blue Oyster Cult, correct?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So you have any recollections from those recording sessions recording with Blue Oyster Cult?
I tell you, it's terrible. I sort of don't. But then, of course, I heard the record. And many years later, Albert he had a kid in the same school I was in. And we did like this parents' night, this gig. And we sang and we did the songs, you know, that I sang. What is it, Doctor?
One track is Dr. Music.
Dr. Music, did Dr. Music, And so it certainly brought everything back, but that was so much fun because he's like this really great guy. And here we were singing for the parents of, you know, our kids' friends. And that was a fun thing. But the sessions, I don't know, it must have been so quick I was in and out. So I don't have real deep recollections of it.
Fair enough. And then after that, though, you did your first solo record with the Dream Team, Ellen, with Ian Hunter and Mick Ronson. What was that creative chemistry like?
Oh, it was great. You know, it was like, they were consummate professionals, but more like consummate artists. So I went in there and, you know, felt really safe. And Ian was kind of like the general in the troop, you know. You know, was the tougher one. And then Mick, you know, he had a very, what word do I use? I don't want to say sneaky. You don't think he's really controlling things, but then he really is. So just the two of them, their talents and their personalities mesh so well. And they kind of, you know, through demos we did and through, I brought him a lot of material and songs that I had written, you know, it meshed together and they understood what it was I did.
One of your strengths is that you're great at collaborating with artists. Like David Bowie would collaborate with Mick Ronson and then maybe with Brian Eno. And every time it's this different, unique combination that only those artists could make. When you're collaborating with people, is it actually when you're collaborating with Ian Hunter and Mick Ronson, was it fluid and easy or was there like a lot of battles going on? How does that magic, I guess, come about?
I wouldn't say, you know, during the pre-production and production, there were battles. There were battles between me and Ian during the mix, because, you know, I, of course, as probably most vocalists in the world, wanted my voice to be louder because, you know, it's a very big wall of sound kind of production. And, you know, I wanted to be out front there. So eventually, you know, that was my first record, to Ian, I was just some kid. So he sort of banned me from being in the studio, which, you know, on hindsight, you know, I should have been like, fuck you, man, this is my record. But, you know, it's what happened. But I think we had fun, you know, during the actual recording of it. It was pretty relaxed and fun. But, you know, I mean, that's how they made you feel, but they were really getting the work done. It was, I thought it was fun. It was great.
And then I think you recorded parts for Sandinista before your second solo album, correct?
It was done like around the same time, all those tracks, mine and there in the Sandinista record. They were doing the Sandinista record, and then I would come in and, you know, sessions would be booked with them and with other, with members of the Blockheads and Time and Dog. And it was Paul and Topper and Mick, but then it brought in other people, so it became sort of my band on top of the Clash, you know.
At the time, what was like the Clash's working relationship? Were they getting along, collaborating? Were they breaking down? Do you have any recollection of that?
I don't think they were breaking down, but they I think it was always kind of a very energized, what's the word, that it was, you know, it was a creative relationship in that it wasn't always smooth sailing, but that's the kind of band it was, you know, that's the kind of people they were, you know. They weren't the Eagles. They weren't some laid back band. They were punks, you know, and they weren't always going to get along. And so it was kind of like that. But I think there was a basic deep affection. So that's why it kept going, you know.
You didn't happen to run into Mikey Dredd during those sessions, did you?
Yeah.
Mikey Dredd, you did?
I think. I'm sure all those kind of guys, I mean, you know, were around. I think, you know, I mean, he didn't sing on any of the tracks or anything like that. He might have been on theirs, you know, but, you know, you're getting me at a time when this was a long time ago, and you know, some of the details. But I definitely met Mikey Dread. Sure, he was around. You know, that whole that kind of band. You know, they have the whole group of people. You know, and you know, there was a lot of, you know, of the reggae influence back then, and so there were people around like that. Yeah.
That album that you recorded that time, Spirit of St. Louis, is kind of regarded as a cult classic. It really is a pretty cool record. What's your perspective of that record?
I listened to it, I guess, a month or two ago, and I hadn't. And my takeaway is that the songs, some of them are really good. The production is kind of amazing. You know, all the risks that were taken, and sound effects and instrumentation. I would say my favorite song on there is, I almost said Hitsville, UK, because it reminds me of it, is Torchlight, because it's very accessible. I always just say, I think it's a great record, but I feel that I'm the weakest link on it.
Really?
Because, you know, I see myself as a big belter singer, and that's what I started out being, and then all of a sudden I'm sort of subdued, like a, you know, this neo cabaret kind of singing. But hey, I think it's an amazing thing to have on my resume and as a life experience. So, but I just don't hear myself on it all the way through, you know.
Fair enough. Speaking of belting it out, there's this unreleased track called Blonde Rock and Roll, which is like you and Mick Jones, I think. Do you remember that song at all? It's an unreleased track.
I don't think that was me. Was it me?
According to the internet, it's you, but maybe it's not. You know, the internet's wrong sometimes.
No, it might be. I should go back and hear it. I mean, what a cool title. It sounds like something that I would have been into. So I should go back and listen to it. Let's say yes, it was me, and I was about me because it was Blonde Rock and Roll, and I love that. I love that idea.
Now, another breath in the credits. There's backing vocals, Lou Christie. Is that the famous singer, Lou Christie?
Yes, it was. You know, Lightning Strikes falsetto, Lou Christie. He was a friend of Vinnie Poncia, who was the producer, and he came and sang backup, and I always loved his stuff, because it had that same, you know, super dramatic quality to it, you know, and so it was kind of a thrill. But he was like super nice, and just that voice is so unique and great. It was cool.
I always think it's amusing that Sandinista has Lightning Strikes not once but twice, and then on your next record you've got Lou Christie who sang Lightning Strikes, you know. And around that time you were in King of Comedy, one of Scorsese's most famous films. Did you meet Scorsese at all, and what was it like being in that film?
Well, you know, we met him because, you know, he was a big fan of the band. So we all went out to dinner, and that's when he was married to Isabella Rossellini. So that was really cool. But a really cool thing was that he said, "Oh, you know, I carried your first album around, your Night Out album around, and listened to it all the time, because I was thinking about casting you in this part, you know, the Sandra Bernhard part." But he didn't. But the fact, you know, when you like, "Oh, Scorsese knows who I am and listen to me," and but, you know, that's always when somebody like that, it's like I once met Stephen King, because he was doing a musical that I don't think anything ever happened with John Mellencamp. And then I went in, I'm like, "Oh crap, Stephen King's like my hero, my favorite." He goes, "Oh, Ellen Foley, I'm a big fan of yours." I'm like, "Oh, come on, my life. How did I get here?" You know, it was so neat.
And then I guess not that long after that, you were in Fatal Attraction, like one of the most famous movies of the 80s. Like, that's a massive film, you know.
I know.
What's it like seeing yourself on the big screen that way, and then being part of one of the biggest films of the decade? I mean, what's it like to have that experience, you know?
Well, it was really fun, because I'd say the biggest scene I was in was a scene where it was a dinner And it was this guy, Stuart Pankin, who's playing my husband, and Michael Douglas and Ann Archer. And it was really, I mean, you know, you start filming early in the morning, and we were actually drinking, you know, I don't know if we were drinking champagne or wine or whatever it is. So here we are. And the whole thing was basically improvised. And this Adrian Lyne, the director, really encouraged that kind of thing. So when I see that on, you know, on film, and I'm like, oh, I made that line up, you know, and it was really in, you know, because I was, you know, I'm sitting there next to Michael Douglas and just, you know, having a party. And I love that. That was the biggest scene I was in, I think, in that movie. But then, you know, I always say, you know, I get small parts in really big movies. And so, that, you know, that was obviously a big deal.
In Night Court, you were there for pretty much the entire season two, I think. When you watch these retrospective on sitcoms or evening sitcoms, you know, on MASH, like, most of the people got along. But I was surprised to learn that on Family Matters, like, Urkel and Carl Winslow didn't get along at all. What was the experience like working on Night Court, and I guess the behind the scenes, were people getting along? Was it a working relationship? What was that experience like for you?
It was everybody got along. It was fine. You know, I mean, I was in kind of a weird position because one day I lived in New York and the next day I was in LA, you know, and I was by myself, you know, everybody had families and I didn't really know anybody. So it was kind of, I don't know. I don't know if the way I was feeling, I had a stupid boyfriend in New York that I was thinking about all the time, I guess. Not that he was stupid, but the relationship was. Maybe he was stupid. I don't know. But so, you know, I don't know if the way I was feeling or not really feeling close to people was super conducive to being funny, to tell you the truth. I mean, I love John Larroquette. You know, he was great. And I saw him, you know, in New York a couple of times after the fact. And Selma Diamond was so inspiring. You know, she really opened up the path for so many female comedians and writers. Yeah, it was fun. It was, but you know, it wasn't the way it would have been years later. You know, if I had a family, if I felt really secure and all that. But you know, in terms of getting along with other people, you know, it was fine. It was congenial. So I think the best word I can come up with.
Well, then, you were Principal Kelly on four episodes of Ghost Rider, and for many people of a certain age, Ghost Rider was the afternoon show choice. You know what I mean?
It was. What was it like? Because I didn't know, because you know I was on it a couple of times, and I, you know, two or three times, and I didn't know how long it continued or it really became a thing. It was on PBS, right?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that was another one of those things you drop in and that's it. But I think, and on one thing, because, you know, the producers, the writers knew me as a singer. So all of a sudden they had a Principal Kelly up there during a school meet. What do they call it when the school gets together and meets?
Assembly.
An assembly. You know, Principal Kelly's up there in assembly, and all of a sudden she starts belting something out. And one of the, I'll never forget, they had a shot of one of the kids, and he was like, well, what the F is what his face looked like? He wasn't like, ooh, listen to her singing. He's like, eh, why is this woman singing? You know, so it was kind of fun. I think maybe Samuel Jackson was in it. Am I wrong? Could he have been in it?
He could have. I'm not sure. I just think it's so surreal that, you know, you're watching this show about, you know, teens solving murders and whatever with a ghost. And there's Ellen Foley, you know, so no. It's so surreal. But listen, speaking of real, you've got this new album out called Fighting Words, which I've heard it. It's really cool. If people like Ellen Foley's music, Ellen mentioned with regards to Spirit of St. Louis that like maybe she doesn't quite belt it out like she does, but on the Elite track, I'm Just Happy to Be Here, it rocks. Ellen is really singing. Ellen, what was the genesis of this album? Why did you decide, all right, I'm going to put out a new album and I'm going to call it Fighting Words?
I think, you know, that my partner in crime, my weird little brother, Paul Foglino, you know, we had been working together for like 15 years. We put one album out, and then he just, I'd say almost 5 years ago, he started writing his songs, because I think then he started getting to know me better and better. And then during the composing of and producing of the record was when I'd like to call him Voldemort was president. So I think it's probably, you know, fighting words has to do with that. And, you know, in living, you know, through a dark time. And that's how I think, you know, I'm just happy to be here is really emblematic of people. You know, it's me and Carla DeVito saying, you know, we have, you know, we're resilient and we have our own lives and, you know, we're making it work, you know, and we've woven through all sorts of time and maybe negative periods. It was a negative period, but we felt strong. And that's what it comes out to be, I think.
You mentioned that the song is about having ups and downs. How are you feeling right now? Are you feeling good right now? Or are you feeling down right now? Where are you at?
No. You know, I'm good. You know, I've been good for a long time because, I'm very fortunate. I have, you know, I have a good family. I have two sons who are grown, you know, I have a great husband, two dogs who are, you know, make up for the loss of the children, because obviously they don't live here anymore. And I mean, right now I'm upstate. We have this beautiful house. It's gorgeous. We've been here, I'd say, you know, since March 2020 for the most part. And then we really live in the city. And I really want to say this fall, listen, man, I'm not a country girl. We live in the city. We are going back, you know, so I have the best of both worlds. And, I've come to, you know, I don't have any, I'm thrilled. God, I'm thrilled that we made this record and people really seem to like it. I mean, and somebody said to me, you know, when people come back after a while, after an age, they come back in a different genre, like American Songbook or jazz or something. But you came back with a real rock and roll record. And, you know, I mean, I'm very thrilled about it, you know. So I am. I'm in a good mood. I'm in a very good mood.
It sounds real good. It closes with something of a poignant song, "Heaven Can Wait," written by Jim Steinman, who sadly passed away like 3 months ago, 2 months ago, 3 months ago.
Yeah, yeah.
So tell me about the importance of that track, the closing track, to you.
Well, I mean, that song, you know, when we're talking about that period between the National Lampoon show and doing the album, we did a show. I was in a gym show called Neverland at the Kennedy Center in DC. And, you know, Neverland was about, I mean, it's Jim's continuing theme through his career, you know, culminating in the show, the Bat Out of Hell musical. But, you know, about these lost boys. It's a Peter Pan, but a you know, end of times Peter Pan kind of dark telling. And I played Wendy in it, and I sang "Heaven Can Wait," and that was maybe 77. You know, and you know, me, it had been in Meat's, you know, repertoire, you know, but I think I might have been the first person to sing it out loud in front of people. And I've sung it in every band, you know, in every show I've ever done ever since. And that recording, you can hear that it sounds totally different than the rest of the album, because it was recorded for, I was in a an indie film about 10 years ago now, called Lies I Told My Little Sister. And it was recorded for the soundtrack for that. And it was produced by this guy, Andrew Williams, who was, I don't know if you know who Andy Williams was, but he was a famous singer back in the 60s.
The country singer, Andy Williams?
No, Andy Williams was more of a like a crooner, a smooth, you know, very relaxed kind of, and he had a TV show. He's very famous. So anyway, this is his son, who's a producer, and the way it worked, you know, he sent me this track he made, and you know, it's orchestral sounding and it's big, and so it's more, I guess, of an extra a track on the record because it's, you know, completely separate. But to me, it, you know, I, on all my records, I like to end with something that's really meaningful. And I mean, this might be one of the most meaningful songs in my life, you know, my career, my performing, is Heaven Can Wait.
Well, the album really is good. I dig it a lot. People can pre-order it now. It's out August 6th on 2021. Ellen's got it on her Bandcamp. And Ellen, listen, thank you for the interview. This has been a real thrill, and it's been super fun hearing about all your – actually, I have one last question for you. When you look it back at all these crazy things that you've done, you know, like, does it seem like a long – adventure, or is it like a blink of an eye? Because you've done so many crazy things, you know.
No, you know, it does seem like a long adventure. It seems like it's been a really, you know, it's not like, oh my god, you know, what happened to my life, blah blah blah, because I did so many things. So no, it seems like a long, strange trip it's been, you know. Much as I hate the Grateful Dead, I think that was a line there. There's a blonde girl up hanging out of my mind. Don't think it's her. I'm gonna look for cover, I'm gonna fall right behind. We can take my car, put me under the tool. Don't think it's her. Don't think it's her. If you have everything, if I could repossess my
me tonight. shake and say.